Hello and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of your co-hosts on the Undisclosed podcast. Today I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Rabia Chowdhury. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you, Colin?
Doing great. And I'm, as an evidence professor, especially disturbed by what you've uncovered in this case. And I'm very excited to discuss this today on the podcast. We'll also be discussing it with Jennifer Leahy, joining us this season on the Addenda. She is a research and investigative assistant who has been working with Rabia going back to the Jason Carroll case. And so, Jen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great and disturbed at the same time. And that is because we're dealing with episode 9, The Hair, today. And so this is all about the hair analysis, as well as the gun evidence. We'll discuss both of those in detail. But first, Rabia, if we can go ahead and queue up a few of the SpeakPipe messages we received about this series.
Yeah, let's. We have gotten a bunch of SpeakPipes, but we're because I really want to focus. And this was a big episode, I know. And by the way, you know, this is not stuff that I've uncovered. This is evidence that, you know, Tammy Moll, that others who have worked on this case for years have uncovered, and painstakingly. And by the way, there's even more hair nuttiness that we're going to get to in next week's episode. Yeah. But I did want to like get to a couple of these speak pipes. So let's take a listen. Our first message comes from Christian.
Hey guys, my name's Christian. I actually grew up in Slayton. I was born in 1990, so I'd been pretty young when this all occurred, but I've checked with my father, who was a bit older than me at the time, and I tried to ask him about whether he remembers any Christmas tree farms in the area where the body was found, trying to dig into that theory a bit. Not totally debunked, but he doesn't remember any Christmas tree farms in that area, so happy to do some research on that. Definitely very familiar with the area. Still live up here in a neighboring town of Palmerton. Would be happy to look into it a little bit further for you guys. But as far as I know, I never remember a Christmas tree farm in that area. I wouldn't say that that is totally debunked, by the way, either, because I know it was always a dream of mine to just go into the woods and cut down a tree that looked really nice rather than having to go and actually pay for a Christmas tree at one of the farms that are nearby. But just want to give you my two cents on that and give you the opportunity to talk with somebody in the area. So let me know if you guys have any other questions about the surrounding area from where the body was found.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for that question. Or actually, not really a question. It's more of a comment, I guess. Here's the point about the Christmas tree thing. I mean, I think Jen is the one who first like picked up on this. It's a weird thing that Andy repeats a couple of times. It does not mean that there were actual Christmas tree farms out there. And it's something Joe wouldn't have known. It is a theory that it could have been a premise to get her out into this rural area, where if you drove me out into the woods and said, we're going to a Christmas tree farm, guess what? I'd believe you too. And in 1994, she had no way to Google it or figure out where she's going. So, but I appreciate the feedback. What do you guys think?
I don't know about the two of you, but like, in Virginia Beach, we'd have some like permanent Christmas tree farms. But then like every year, there'd be some different locations that would have them. So it wouldn't necessarily be a permanent thing. But in a given year, there might be a farm where there wasn't one the year before, the year after.
Yeah. I mean, look, if he said that to her, I don't think he was taking her to a farm, period. Right.
Right.
There's that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the most important part. If that, it's like there wasn't. But for what it's worth, and I don't want to contradict the listener's memory or experience, and I did find like some, I went back into papers from like the early 90s, and there were ads for
I love for, it of course you I, did I, Jen that's why you're my that's why
it's
you're
the due diligence
yeah. I mapped them. I have like a Google map, you know, and I threw and within a few miles, right? Now I don't know how much people, you know, like if whether somebody living down in Catasauqua would have gone up there, you know, yeah, and they seem pretty well established. Like they were actually farms where you grew. Like I know, I work for a guy here that has an orchard. And he just started growing Christmas trees, and it's like an investment, right? Like it takes like 8-10 years before the trees are even ready to harvest. Yeah. So some of these farms have been around for a long time. But
do you still have some of those ads, Jennifer Sage? Maybe we could throw them on our Facebook community. Okay, maybe we could. Could you post them on our Facebook community group, and then you guys can check them out there. See what Jennifer.
Absolutely.
Talking
about. But all like right. you said, the most important point was if for some reason that was something that happened, it wouldn't matter, right? It wouldn't matter because that was not where they were going.
Yeah, it was just a pretense. Yeah. All right, so let's listen to the next one. And this comes from, I believe, John.
Hey, Robbie and Colin, this is John. And last night, after listening to the addendum from, I think it's addendum week 8, I watched The Wrong Man. And they had a medical examiner look at the autopsy reports. And they determined that the baby was closer to 6 months old than 3 months old. And if we're going on the idea of that Andy went to work that day, the last time Joe talked to her sister was the day before. It's quite possible that he did something to them that night, if allegedly, or she ran off. What the show said is that maybe she ran off that day, and then was possibly found. Has there been any investigation on if the baby's 6 months old, where she would have been all that time?
Yeah, so I've seen this theory floating around the internet, and I watched the episode. So, Robbie, let's start by grounding this and saying, how old was baby Alex on the day that he and Joe disappeared?
15 weeks is my understanding. Right. Almost 4 months old.
And so, have you watched this episode? What do you make of this medical examiner saying he's closer to 6 months old when the body is?
You know, I did, but it's been a while since I watched it, and I have no recollection of it. What did you make of it? What was the basis of that finding?
I think it was just like on the size and the bone and, you know, how big and developed the child was.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember. Jen, do you remember it as well?
I loosely remember it. My impression from it was maybe a medical person weighing in, and based on like growth charts, you know, like you know how you can be like in the X percentile, you know, saying that maybe baby Alex would have been at a high percent. But my understanding with those also having, you know, like is there's some kids that are going to be off the charts, right? So there's no way to say like 100%.
I just took my 9-year-old for his physical last week. He is 99% height and weight, which if somebody just looked at his charts, they think he's 16 years old, but he's 9. He's just a really big boy. And so, you know, I don't think that's, but I have read, and of course, this is not my expertise, that head circumference is a better indicator of age for infants, except that in this case, because of the level of decomposition, that really wasn't like, I don't think, an available way to, I don't know if they're able to take a proper head circumference in that. Right. The other thing I was going to say is this. His dad is a big guy, right? Like, I mean, like Andy was a big dude. I mean, it could be the baby was just a couple percentiles higher than like the norm. They're just looking at norms, right? But also the baby is wearing the clothes that people knew the baby owned, right? Like, unless you're going to make the argument that like more clothes were bought, this and that. You know, by 6 months, he would have been eating food. It's the same formula that he was taking to begin with, right? Like, there's just no, I don't think there's any evidence to support it. So I really don't agree with that conclusion. What do you think, Colin?
Well, this will flow nicely into question 3 on SpeakPipe, because you just mentioned Joe was small, but Andy was quite big. So let's play the third SpeakPipe message.
This comes to us from Ariana.
Do we know if Andy has any kids, like any other kids besides Alex?
I'm going to let Jen answer that, because Jen did the research on that.
I haven't found any evidence of it from what I have access to. I haven't seen any suggestions of it. I haven't heard anybody or, you know, anecdotally saying anything. I found it in like a local paper or publication from Colorado. His second wife at the time, like they were doing some sort of like interview with her. It wasn't related to the case at all. It was like she'd moved to the area and I think she had her own business or something. And she actually says in the interview, like, we're trying to have kids, because they ask her if they have kids.
Right.
If they have them, I haven't seen, you know, like I haven't, there's nothing that has jumped out to me as them having kids in a household. But I mean, I can't totally rule it out.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as far as we know, no. but I don't know. I mean, like, you know, it's if somebody's not putting on social media, like how do you really find that out even?
Yeah.
There's one more message, so let's take a listen.
Yeah, let's play the fourth, and that'll flow into our discussion of the hair evidence.
This one comes to us from Jessica.
Hi, my name is Jessica Rodriguez. I love you guys. Thank you for the work that you do. And the first thing that I was thinking of when I was listening to this week's episode was that enough time for her to fully grow out between the crime and her arrest? Was it enough time for her hair to fully grow out? And at 3 years, definitely is. And I wanted to make sure that people understood that point, because that was one thing that stopped me in my tracks for a second. And the second thing that is holding me up a little bit, although I, first of all, trust you guys and also completely understand that police lie. How many different police, FBI, or state law enforcement divisions do you think didn't tell the truth? And can you break that down for us? Thank you. Bye.
Okay, I'll start with this second question first. Yeah. I haven't really seen evidence of like direct misconduct by the FBI in this case, and you know, Tammy might counter me on this. I do think, I mean, unless you can say the fact that they just did not follow up on all the leads that, you know, Patty gave them over and over her alibis, that's more like negligence versus actual misconduct. But so you have the FBI, but then because it's, you know, across, there's two different states involved, so the FBI is involved and it's a big case. Then you have the Pennsylvania State Police, and then you have the Davidson County, North Carolina Sheriff's Office involved. Those are the three law enforcement agencies. Putting aside the FBI, without a doubt, the detectives from the Sheriff's County, Davidson Sheriff's County, there was actual misconduct. And I promise you before the season's over, it's going to either be the last episode or it's going to be the last addendum. I'm going to prove it, like just using like three or four different points in time where it's obvious. But, you know, this episode is all about, this past episode, episode 9, was all about whether or not the hair was switched, right? Like, and if it was switched, it had to be because of the misconduct from one or more parties at the Pennsylvania State Police. And so that means at least two law enforcement agencies here were engaged in some misconduct. It doesn't have to be a huge conspiracy. It can just be a couple of people. What was the other question? Oh, about her hair growing out. Yeah, go ahead.
Add on to that, Rabia, which is what I've noted. The study found the FBI, in the years covering Patty's case, in 95% of hair analysis cases, they had false positives based upon mishandling the evidence, flawed expertise, all the things we're discussing in this case. And so you can believe the FBI was nefarious, or you can just believe, as in 95% of the cases during the time, their protocol was atrocious led to these false positives.
Yeah. When it comes specifically to the hair stuff, I don't see any misconduct necessarily by the FBI. I do see you're saying.
Intentional, you're
right.
It could be unintentional.
100%. I think the protocol was terrible. I think like all that's totally true. But in terms of like procuring the evidence, just to nail Patty, I don't really see their hand in it necessarily. Or they looked away. I mean, how, Dr. Jensen, do you, or you know, the Dr. Dedman, Dr. Jensen, examine the same hair you examined before? You're like, oh, look, a root. You know, like, come on.
Right. And then the first part of the question, let's build the timeline here so we can lay this out detail by detail, date by date to the listeners. And so for either of you, do we have the exact date in 1994 when Patty gets her hair permed and bleached?
No, we don't know when this was something ongoing. Okay. You know, but her roots were grown out, so it had been a minute since she got it done. Okay.
Right.
But we know on December 5th, when that photograph was taken,
the photo
was taken. Right. Again, you guys can see the photo in our title images, but her hair was long, dirty blonde and with dark roots for sure. At least I would say 2 or 3 inches worth of dark roots came to about her shoulder and it was permed.
Right. So her hair is permed and bleached in December 1994.
Yeah.
Then when the police find the hairs and they recover these dirty blonde hairs, Patty's response when they say that ties you to the crime is what?
She's like, I don't have dirty blonde hair. Now this happens.
Right.
They don't collect her hair from her head until about a year later.
Right. And this is the question asked by the listener. How long does it take for the bleach and the perm chemicals to go out of the hair?
Yeah. Look, I don't know. She might have dyed her hair again brunette. Like she might have just, you know, I don't know if she let it actually grow out. I will say this. It's a whole year. And she was pregnant. Pregnant women grow hair like you wouldn't believe.
Right.
Could she have cut it out and it was growing over the course of the year and it gotten back down to her shoulder? I know that I could have. Everybody has different growth rates because we're not talking about hair down to her back. We're just talking about to her shoulder. So a year of hair growth for a pregnant woman, maybe. But even if she had gone ahead and had it, if she had just gone, dyed her hair brown again, which was her natural color just to like bring it back in, the point is not that. The point is that the original hairs that were tested by the FBI lab when they first got them, before they got Patty's hair, says that not ARTRX, which means not.
And this is the bombshell moment, right? RRX, ARTRX, or not RX. Dr. DeZinno, as you note, Ravia, says this means the hair was not artificially treated.
Right. The first, when they first got the hairs, this is in 1995. This is like in May or June of May 1995. Remember, the hair is collected in December 17th. That's when they have the car and they're finally collecting all this stuff. That's the hair from the car. Then the hair from the crime scene, the diaper bag and they keep calling it the forest litter, but like, you know, the leaves and the woods. That's collected in April because that's when the bodies are found. The stuff is turned over to them in May and they return it. They say, and that's enough. So there's two issues here. Number one is whether the hairs that would eventually match to Patty were the same ones collected in crime scene evidence.
We'll get to in a second.
That's the first issue. And if they were not, was there an opportunity for them to be switched? That's the second issue. So let's break that down.
Yeah. And so, let's start with the artificial treatment. Then we'll get to the mounting versus unmounting and the sealed and all that. So, right, Ravia, like, we're looking at you because the hair from the crime scene is dirty blonde. My hair's not dirty blonde. It is in December 1994. Here's the photo. And then, Ravia, as you say, we have this report from Dr. DeZinno. The hairs we're looking at here were not artificially treated, which means these would not be Patty's hairs from December 1994, right? It's impossible.
If she committed that crime in December 15th, 1994, the hair they collected from the crime scene would have been artificially treated in more than one way. It would have been permed and bleached.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, obviously, is that, so let's just talk about that initial analysis, right? Like when they first get so this is the FBI lab, by the way. So the Pennsylvania State Police collect the evidence, they take it to the FBI lab. And the reason they do that is because the FBI lab does not have the ability to do mitochondrial testing.
Right.
If they're,
which is new at the time. Yeah.
I mean, it's not even a thing yet because this is 1995.
Nascent. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they send it to the FBI because they're like, the FBI might be able to do testing on it. We can't. However, the question is this. Was the Pennsylvania State Lab able to do nuclear testing at the time? And if they had been, then why didn't they just hold on to the hairs if there was a root? Right? Like, so the issue of whether or not there was a root is really big here. Okay. So you have the Pennsylvania State Lab saying, we're sending it to the FBI. The FBI, you know what they do? They send it back. They send it back and they say, number one, the loose hair is contaminated. Okay. The Q1 loose hairs, the Q1 hairs are the ones collected from the car, the loose ones, not mounted. And right. we actually have, I'll read it exactly from the lab report. It says, hold on a second. Okay. It says several stained areas. This is from a 1995, summer of 1995 lab report. I think it's June from the FBI. Several stained areas of the Q1 hairs were swabbed, and these swabs were subjected to DNA analysis. The DNA obtained from specimen Q1 is from more than one individual. Because of this mixture, no conclusive DNA typing results were obtained. So they're like, well, we've got these hairs that are loose. We can't do any DNA testing on them because there's like, we can't, you know what I mean? There's like, it's contaminated.
And that's because Dr. Jensen,
yeah,
not an expert in hair analysis, took one class decades ago, yeah, handled the hair with without gloves.
Look, it's even I know. I mean, here's the thing. I don't care if it's DNA, any evidence from a crime scene, they should, for 100 years, police should know you don't pick it up with your hands, okay? Now, from that same report, I'm going to continue reading. Oh, actually, no. This is a later report, but it supplements the earlier reports. It says, this report supplements the FBI lab reports in this case, and they have a couple earlier dates. It says, attempts to remove the Q4 through Q6 hairs from the mounting medium in which they are embedded in an attempt to conduct DNA analysis from these hairs has been successful. Which hairs are these? There are three more hairs collected from the car. So you've got six hairs, three mounted, three unmounted. The mounted ones, they're like stuck together. We can't get to them. The unmounted right. ones are contaminated. Now, so that's the summer of 95. Let's fast forward, okay? The FBI says that in October of 1995, this is what they say. They sent everything back to the Pennsylvania State Police because they're like, we can't do nothing with it, all right? Then there is a police report a month later from the Pennsylvania State Lab. And they say, we've got all eight hairs, the six from the car and two from crime scene. Plus, guess what? We have 50 plus hairs collected from Patricia Rohr.
Right.
Okay. Because they have just plucked the hair from her head like 2 days earlier.
Which likely would not be chemically treated at this point.
She might have dyed it brown. She might not have. Right. But the point is, it wasn't blonde anymore.
Right.
Right. And maybe the police were like, it doesn't matter if it was blonde now, it was blonde back then. Mm-hmm. But the problem is not whether it's blonde or brown or whatever. The point is it was chemically treated in December 94. And the hairs collect that are matched when DNA testing is eventually done are not chemically treated. Or sorry, when Dizino first looks at them are not chemically treated. Okay. Now, this is the big issue. This is where all of Patty's attempts to prove her innocence have fallen through the cracks, because what the Pennsylvania State Lab says and the state alleges is that the FBI never returned the hair to us. So we couldn't have switched it. They kept all that hair evidence we collected from the crime scene. We never like, so, and by the way, the FBI says we returned it and they have a documentation of it. The Pennsylvania State Lab says that we don't have anything. What they did do is write a memo November 16th saying that the original eight hairs to be tested are still with the FBI lab. So it's almost like they're already laying the ground to show that we never got it, except
we know.
Right. Except there's so many reasons. By the way, so that this is actually from, so there's a lab, there are evidentiary logs, okay? If you look at the logs, log entry that Pennsylvania police, and I don't know, we could post this, I guess, online, from November 15th, that says that they had evidence submitted to them, okay, from the FBI. And it's been entered into evidence by Detective, I think it says Tunk is how we looked at it, or Corporal Tunk, T-U-N-K. There's a badge number. So he says on 11/15, something was returned to them from the FBI. It doesn't say what it was, is the problem. The next day is when the Pennsylvania lab goes back to the FBI and says, we've got Patty's hair. We plucked it from her head. Now you can compare it. What Patty alleges and what I believe to be true is that not only do they have Patty's hair, they had gotten back the original hair samples, and this was their opportunity to switch them out. And if they did that, and then the FBI now has Patty's hair, and they have the hair from the crime scene evidence has been switched with Patty's actual hair, it would explain, right. It would explain, number one, why those hairs are why those hairs now suddenly have a root.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to also play something. I want to play this interview with Dr. DeZinno. Again, Dr. DeZinno was the forensic expert at the FBI. He was one of two who was conducting the DNA testing at the FBI. He gave this interview in 2017. And the interview is on the Jerry Williams FBI retired case file review podcast, and you can look it up. Just look up Joseph DeZinno podcast, FBI retired case file review.
So as I progressed, it became apparent now that DNA was evolving, started being used in 1989, 1990, but we did not have a means of characterizing DNA from a single hair. Because there's really two types of DNA, DNA from the nucleus of the cell and DNA from mitochondria of the cell. And in a single hair found at a crime scene with no tissue on the root, we could not characterize nuclear DNA because there just was not enough present. And based on the biology, there in that single hair, there is mitochondrial DNA sufficient to perform a mitochondrial DNA analysis on that hair. But when in the early 90s, we did not have a means for analyzing mitochondrial DNA from a single hair. And so the laboratory took it upon itself to perform research, and I was involved in that research with mitochondrial DNA research with a number of individuals from the laboratory. And we spent several years at Quantico in the research facility, the laboratory research facility at Quantico, where we developed a protocol procedure to characterize mitochondrial DNA from a single hair, and we also apply it to bones and teeth that may be degraded, have been exposed to the environment for a long time, and there's not enough nuclear DNA present. Mitochondrial DNA generally will be present in order to obtain a mitochondrial DNA profile from those individuals. So, while I took a break from my casework in the early 90s for several years to perform mitochondrial DNA analysis research, we started to use it in casework in approximately 1996 or so. And from there, they grew into a unit within the laboratory and still exists today in the FBI laboratory where they perform mitochondrial DNA examinations.
Here, what he says is, in this first part of this clip, he's saying that in the early 90s, they couldn't get basically what he's saying is they couldn't get mitochondrial DNA. They had spent several years of research. And I'm going to fast forward to this, the part that, I mean, which is also good to, I mean, we know what their capabilities were and weren't. So when did they then get the capability to do that? Let's see.
So, we now, Patricia Rohr becomes a suspect in the case. She apparently said she was not in Pennsylvania at the time of the murders, and through investigation they found either receipts, I don't recall exactly what, that put her in Pennsylvania about the time of the murders. So now we get a known head hair sample from Patricia Rohr, and she had dyed her hair since the time of the murder, but about a quarter of an inch of the hair that was not dyed down near the root did look like, in the microscope, the hair is found on the seat back. So now we performed, now the interesting part of this case is the crime occurred in 1994 and didn't go to trial until 1998. And part of that delay was because the prosecutor's office in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, had somehow learned that we were performing research on mitochondrial DNA analysis in the FBI laboratory. And he waited to prosecute this case until we were up and running with our analysis. So he waited until we were ready to go. And once we were ready to go and we were online with it, we had done all our validation studies and had our standard operating procedures. He then submitted the evidence to the laboratory for us to perform mitochondrial DNA analysis on the hair. And when we did that, we had a known sample from Patricia Rohr and the mitochondrial DNA from the hairs on the seat back. And the mitochondrial DNA sequence from the hairs matched the mitochondrial DNA sequence from Patricia Rohr. So again, you can't say that those hairs on the seat back came from Patricia Rohr to the exclusion of everybody else in the world. However, you cannot eliminate those hairs on the seat back as having come from Patricia Rohr.
Okay, so one of the things I want to point out in that second clip was that he said that the state resubmitted the hair to them when they had the capability, which completely destroys the narrative that the FBI held on to the hair for, what, 2 years or whatever it was, a year and a half, to then test it and get their mitochondrial results. It would have been 2 years. So, you know, I don't know. They didn't have the capability to do the testing. So they returned it. You know, he doesn't talk about it being contaminated. And I'm sure all these years later, he doesn't remember every single detail. But he does say that the prosecutor resubmitted the hairs to them. Where else do we want to go from here?
I mean, look, I'll sort of break down my bullet points and then see what Jen's take on all this is. My bullet points are, one, this hair in the report by the FBI expert says it is not artificially treated, which means this is definitely not hair from Patty Rohr in December 1994. Two, we have the so-called state expert who is not an expert in hair analysis at all, and we can see some of the weird experiments in terms of the length of the hair he did, etc. Three, this so-called expert handled the hair with his hands and contaminated it, meaning the unmounted hair could not be tested for DNA. And then four, there's no way the hair on the mounted slides could be tested for DNA, meaning this is a complete foobar situation where everything went wrong. It's consistent with all this 95% of cases the FBI had some hands in with hair analysis in the time. This impugns the state and the FBI. It does not incriminate Patty at all. So that's my thought. Jen, what is your thought with all this hair evidence in the case?
Yeah, it's hard to like get your head around, right? But I agree that her hair, if it had been in the car in December 1994, that hair should have been chemically, like, there's no way it wasn't chemically treated, you know? And so the fact that somebody looked at it back then and said, this is not a chemically treated hair, like, I don't see how it could be hers. Like, right? And then, I mean, I was just quickly looking back at some of his testimony. I think we talked about this earlier. Like, the fact that he's relabeling exhibits on the stand during trial, I don't know how things normally go. I haven't, you know, attended trials, but that does not
doesn't fill you with confidence.
No. And like, how is that allowed? Is that a thing that's normally allowed? I'm asking you too. Like, does that happen? I mean, I guess it does, but
I have you seen that, Colin?
I'm trying to remember which trial it was. I remember one trial where something I think was mislabeled and they had to change it up on the stand, but I can't remember which trial. Was it Karen Reed? I'm not sure.
The problem here is that it's a lot of hairs.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So keeping them straight is nearly impossible. And you know, and then Jensen brings up that just out of nowhere, nobody asked him. Oh, then yeah, we had to remount some stuff. Wait, what? If you're remounting something, it means it's mounted, except that nobody could get into the mount. There's only three mounted hairs.
Right.
Nobody could get into them. What is the remount? What are you remounting? And that will tie directly into something we're going to talk about next week. Now here, like you guys heard, you know, Dr. Dezino say, it didn't mean that Patty was 100% match. It means she can't be excluded. Okay. That issue, along with all the other, you know, all the issues Colin just raised with the hair evidence, was raised in subsequent appeals, and it was shut down because further DNA testing was done. And we're going to talk about that next week as well, and how that kind of what the results of that were and how they kind of sealed Patty's fate in many ways. But, you know, for him to, then the other thing, one more thing I want to point out about the hair that was eventually tested, the evidence hair that was eventually matched to Patty. And that is that it was specifically written in the notes. I can't remember if it was Dedman or DeZinno at the FBI said that it was a forcibly removed root.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And in terms, I mean, like obviously when they took hair samples from Patty, they didn't just snip ends. They forcibly removed hair from her head. Somebody did raise the question of how many hairs were actually taken from her. And the reason I have said multiple times that it was 50 plus is because the trooper who took the hair said that he was told by the doctor who was supervising at the hospital, or I can't remember if it was the doctor supervising or like who, which both of them were present, right? That when you take hair samples from folks for this kind of, you know, evidentiary, like, you know, comparison, you need to collect 50 plus. So because the trooper said 50 plus a couple of times, that's what I stuck to. Now, there is a point at which the prosecutor brings up, I believe in closing argument, somewhere in trial, that there were 39 hairs taken.
Right.
And whether it was 39 or they were actually counted, I don't know. When Tammy Mall tried to track down every single one of those 39, she could not account for them. Was it 50 plus? We don't know. The whole point is the hair evidence should be thrown out completely.
Yes.
I just think about the jury, but like if like we, or at least I am having, you know, trouble like holding on to all this. They weren't allowed to take notes for the trial. Like, can you imagine sitting through all this and like, how do you make sense of it? How do you keep track of it if you can't even take
I have notes? Had to write it out so many times. Right. And by the way, when I talk about the timeline, that's a very abbreviated timeline. There was so much more stuff. That, I mean, like, because I'm not talking about other evidence that was collected and sent, like, you know, stuff, other things from her car and other things from the house and other items from the crime scene, like the rattle. And then there's so much evidence went back. The fingernails. Hello. We haven't even talked about the fingernail. So, you know, I'm trying to focus just on those hairs that were eventually connected to Patty. All right. So, but, you know, I did make the case that I think it was the hair and the specter of a gun being connected to her.
Which is the other thing that should have been excluded at trial, right? And so this, as an evidence professor, takes us back to the Joy Watkins case. And you might recall, if you listened back then, the idea of grave dog. And this is one of the two appellate issues that led to his conviction being thrown out. A prosecutor can't just come in at trial and say, I have a theory. They need some evidence that connects an alleged murder weapon to the defendant. And Rabia, all they had here was Patty's mom taking a gun to her sister and asking her to hold it. There's nothing at trial that connects this gun to Patty, right?
100%. So, you know, they have Walter Blalock, who's her ex, who's like, I remember she bought this junky gun, right, from a yard sale. Here's what it looked like. It was a little Jennings, fit in the palm of her hand, black. And he described, like, you know, kind of like what the grip looked like. And then a couple of years go by, right before the 2 months before the trial, her half sister is interviewed and she's like, I remember my mom came and gave me a gun to hold.
Right.
And her husband both testified, in fact, and said her mom came and gave me a gun to hold. Their mom they described it in their initial police reports and on the stand as silver and tiny. And the grip's different. Everything about it is different, right? Because that was not the gun that Patty had bought. Now, number one, we know their timeline was completely off because she was tying this memory to her mom's property being searched by the police, which didn't happen for 5 months after this happened. But the other thing is, you know what the prosecutor kept showing the jury? They kept showing them a picture, it's one of the exhibits, a blown up picture of a little black Jennings. It's not Patricia's gun. They never recovered a weapon. So I just think that was, I mean, how was that even allowed, Colin? I don't understand.
I can only assume the defense did not raise a conditional relevance objection because, to your point, there's no connective tissue to the gun that Patty had. You can't just throw out a theory of, well, her mom gave a gun to the sister, and so maybe that was Patty who had given it to her. You need evidence to support that, and there's no evidence to support it here.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, didn't they try their darndest to find, they dug up all these shells from target practice and all these different locations where Patty, you know, and then they couldn't match it to, like, it,
yeah. The type of gun, yeah.
Right, which would mean that if Patty was target practicing with that little gun that she used to murder Joe, she then went through, you know, all the areas she's target practicing and just got rid of the ones connected to that gun, but left all the other ones because there were, I don't know, dozens of shell casings collected, but none of them matched this, you know, the kind of bullets that killed Joe.
Yeah, and so hair evidence should not come in. There's failures all around with chain of custody. The hair is handled without gloves. The hair is not artificially treated. That makes no sense. The gun evidence, there's no condition of relevance. That should not have come in. And so the two big pillars of the state's case fall down. And then, you know, I found especially interesting because, again, going back to the Joe Watkins case, Rabia, we have these jurors. Mm-hmm. And we had some questions on Facebook. I had my own question. Like, what do you think happened with this juror who seemed to be a holdout who just falls ill, like deathly ill at the end of trial?
It's so crazy. She reached out to me. I did not. I knew that an alternate juror had to replace somebody. I didn't know the circumstances of what happened. And, you know, she told me that, look, she's like, it was right. Like she heard closing arguments. And she was like, you have not sold me. Like, I don't believe. And like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you certainly have not met your threshold of beyond a reasonable doubt is how she felt. Now, what's a little hard to understand. And then she got violently ill. It could have been like what I picked up from Bojangles this past weekend. I don't know. But she got violent right before deliberations. And she really thought, she sent a note to the judge. She really thought she was going to be given maybe a couple of hours or maybe, you know, a day to recover. I guess it was on Thursday or Friday of that week. I don't know exactly. But she was replaced immediately. She wasn't even asked. And I don't know how that works. But I assumed they should have been like, are you okay to go on or not? You know what I mean? Or do you want to continue? Yeah. She desperately wanted to be in that in the deliberations. She wanted to because she had felt, and I don't know how, she said that, well, I asked her directly, did you ever have any conversations about what's happening at the trial? She said no, amongst the jury, like when they went to lunch or dinner or whatever. And they were not sequestered, right, Jen? They went home.
Yeah, I believe so. Or at least I'm trying to remember if there was like a partial, you know, if like they stayed over somewhere like at the end. Am I imagining that?
I honestly can't recall myself, but the point
but they did
is
go
that,
home like every night, I think, during the trial.
Well, that's the point.
This
thing is a huge media circus.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, even before the trial began. So,
yes.
You know, I asked her, I said, were there any, do you remember any conversations between the jurors about like watching a media report, you know, and she's like, no, I remember nothing like that. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just, but for some reason, she really felt like she would have been the holdout. She's like, there are some really strong personalities in the jury. And I was like, I don't care what they do. I'm not going to give in to them. And clearly, look, they only deliberated for a number of hours. And they came back and, you know, either the strong personalities won out or they were all, in fact, convinced of Patty's guilt.
Well, and they might have been pre-convinced because...
Right.
Let's move to the start of the trial. And I found this astounding. I can't imagine how they didn't transfer venue. I think the stat I read was that 85% of the people polled in Lehigh Valley were aware of the arrest from media reports.
Right.
And 40% had already decided she was guilty.
Yeah.
I mean, Jen or Robbie, like, what happened with the motion to transfer venue? Why in the world would the judge deny it when 40% of this 85% are saying, I think she's guilty going into the trial?
So what I remember from reading that hearing was that the state argued, yeah, but 60% didn't think she was guilty.
Yeah, but I mean, that's
Jen, am I
not
wrong?
A compelling argument.
It's been a while since I read that pretrial transcript. I don't remember exactly. I do remember that. I mean, just the news coverage, like if you see the visuals on it, like there's people that were waiting like at night for her to arrive and screaming, you know, it's pretty.
Screaming, hang her. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, look, the other thing is, you know, Jen asked me like, why wouldn't a judge transfer this out? I also think there's a bit of a, this is like the biggest thing that's ever happened in Lehigh Valley. I mean, like, I can imagine a judge being like, this is my baby. I am taking, you know what I mean? Like, not even wanting to, to let it go.
But my analogy, there's the infamous Justin Ross Harris case in Georgia, the father who left his kid in the hot car.
Yeah.
And I think if I'm remembering correctly, I played this clip for my students in class. The numbers were significantly lower in terms of knowledge and predetermined guilt. And that judge was like, I am transferring venue. This cannot be heard here. 100%. Like, this is the classic case where you have to move it out of Lehigh Valley.
Right, right. And, you know, the defense said alternatively, can we bring a jury in from elsewhere? He didn't allow that either.
Yeah, we're dealing with that right now in the Alec Murdaugh case. Is that that's a possibility of shipping jurors from outside.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I don't know where they're going to ship them in. They're going to ship them in from overseas.
That's because tougher. That's Murdaugh.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that's it for this week's addendum.
Yeah. So, Rabia, what can you sort of previewed a little bit before, but what can listeners look forward to in episode 10 of the Patty Aurora series?
Episode 10 is going to be what happened post-conviction. You know, obviously that was 1998. It's been a long time since then. And the fight has been relentless to show that Patty's innocent. And we're going to go through some of the people who've been on Patty's team and what they've done and what they've discovered since then and why it hasn't been successful in court.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you, Rabia. Thank you, Jen. And thanks to the listeners. We will see you back next Monday for episode 10 of The State vs. Patricia Rohr.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
If you want even more undisclosed content, remember you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2 with the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.